May it please the court. My name is Robert Smith. I represent the plaintiff.
Speak up.
The plaintiff appellant, Carla Domingo.
You're going to have to raise the level of your voice. That's mostly a recording instrument there.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. I will try and do that.
Okay.
The first thing I should say is I do have a hearing problem, if the court asks questions of me, I may have to ask you to repeat the question several times because I might not get it. What I thought I would do this morning is to talk about some of the factors or aspects of this case which may be different or at least not the same as many of the other cases. I did submit a letter with additional citations of some 9 cases. I didn't file it in triplicate, and it wasn't a week before. But I hope you've received it, and I'll have to have guidance from the court whether I'm to argue the cases or say where they fit in. The recent cases decided since my reply brief was filed, about 9 of them.
If you're comfortable in mentioning them in the proper context, go ahead.
All right, thank you. And once I talk about some of the novel or different aspects of this case, then I can talk about some of the legal issues involved. First of all, many of the cases decided after Greentree foundered over the lack of proof of what the costs were, what the real costs of arbitration were. And that's probably because many of the litigants before the courts in later appeals didn't have Greentree to deal with at the time those cases were heard by the trial courts, and so the proof has often been found lacking. That, I think, is not the case with our situation, because we have provided proof to the trial court of the possible cost of a 7-day arbitration being in excess of $20,000 for my client. And it's broken down in various categories, including the flying of witnesses and herself and her counsel from Hawaii to California, where arbitration is required under the arbitration agreement. So I think the proof is before the court. It was before the trial court, and AmeriQuest has made no objections to that proof. There's no contrary proof, and there's no opposition to the record proof in any of the appellate briefs. So that issue, I think, is not before the court. That is to say, the record contains adequate proof of what the cost of arbitration would be for my client and also her financial situation. Both of those subjects are covered. A second aspect, which is different in this case than most other cases, is how the trial judge dealt with the unfair, what we regard as the unfair provisions of the arbitration agreement. We do not have a situation, as in Greentree, where there was silence on the issue of who pays what. Instead, one of the provisions, in addition to the forum provision about where the arbitration would take place, was a cost or fee splitting provision right in the arbitration agreement, which said my client pays for one half. And that's part of our record proof as to what composes that one half. So we do not have a situation of silence. We therefore have an express provision on it. And so somehow that provision has to be taken care of, either by holding it void and unenforceable or by some other means. And Judge Ballway elected to deal with it in a very different way than in most situations. She asked AmeriQuest to stipulate at the oral argument in the trial court that it would pay all costs you need to arbitration, and AmeriQuest agreed with that. And even though we have made it clear that we reject any unilateral modification of the arbitration agreement, Judge Mulway went ahead and said, all right, this is what AmeriQuest will do, so I'm ordering that agreement on this part performed, and AmeriQuest must pay all the costs. Now, our problem with that is that
Are those the costs that you refer to at pages 8 and 9 of your brief?
Yes, they are.
And am I correct in understanding that Domingo contacted you before the one-year statute had run?
Yes.
But that you did not file until after that had run? I'm not agreeing that it was an effective statute, but the one-year called for in the agreement?
That's right.
And you did not file because your client could not come up with the cost of the arbitration?
That's right. I'd asked her to deposit $5,000, $6,000 in my trust account, and until she did that, we did not file.
Now, but you were representing her?
Yes, I was.
At that time?
Yes. And we had letters going to Ameriquest making initial inquiries into the facts and asking for documents and so forth. And she had written a 8-page letter while she was suspended and outlining her various reasons for protesting what was going on at Ameriquest, the illegal loan transactions. So it's not as if Ameriquest didn't know about what was coming. They did.
I must tell you that is just, you know, we don't confer before we come in here on the merits of the cases. Just as one judge, I am extremely troubled by the fact that you would undertake a representation but not do what was necessary to at least try to protect your client's interest because of monetary arrangements. I mean, it's very troubling.
Well, it's troubling to me, Your Honor. I agree with you.
Especially when it turned out that when you did file in district court, the judge ordered the other side to cover these fees. Is that correct?
The judge ordered the other side to cover the cost, yes.
Cost.
That's right. The cost.
I mean, the issue between you and your client was not fees, right? It was these costs.
No, it was the fees.
My requirement of my client was that she fund the costs, or at least enough of them, that we could undertake the case. That's the $6,000.
Well, your brief says, although counsel then commenced to work on the case, there were financial arrangements which Domingo had to make to cover anticipated litigation costs, bracket, not fees, close bracket, in order for her case to be filed.
Yes.
What were those?
What was it?
What were the litigation costs described in your brief?
It was my estimate of what it would require to pay her expert witnesses and take depositions. At the time I set that requirement of $6,000 in my trust account, I did not know about all these various rules concerning the arbitration expenses, the fees of the arbitrator, the reporter, and so forth, that I learned later on. So I had not asked that she fund that part of it. I didn't know about that part of it.
If that had been a legal statute of limitations about to run, had it been, and not just the contract, would it be all right to tell your client, I represent you, but I will let the statute of limitations run unless you pay some money into my trust account?
No, of course not, Your Honor.
Well, did you not run that risk here if this is a valid agreement?
I did. And not a knowing running of the risk, but that's what happened.
If I have stock interest in your insurer, can I sit on this case?
Yes, you could.
You don't think your insurer would have an interest in whether that letting this year run would expose them to a claim by your client?
Of course.
Well, I can't sit on a case where an interested party is one that I have a stock interest in. And wouldn't that make your insurer an interested party that ought to be disclosed to the court?
You're saying shouldn't my insurance company be before the court?
No, but shouldn't the judges know whether your insurance company has an interest in the outcome of the case so that we can determine whether we are qualified or disqualified?
Well, as a matter of fact, Your Honor, I don't carry insurance, so it's a moot point.
That's a moot point.
But if your Honor is suggesting I have culpability, yes, of course I do. I can only say that at the time I first began working on the case, it was within a month or two of her discharge, and at that point there was no issue about the one-year statute. Then circumstances changed, and she took over a year to fund the trust fund, and in the meantime, the one-year statute cropped up as a problem, and now I have to deal with it.
Have you self-reported this to the State Bar of Hawaii?
No, I have not.
You think you should?
My own potential malpractice, Your Honor?
Yes.
I don't think so. I'm not aware of that kind of obligation. It isn't a matter of ethics. It's a matter of whether I have exposure or liability for something I'm...
You don't think the State Bar, the licensing authorities in Hawaii would have any interest in what happened?
In a potential malpractice case? No, I don't think so. I don't think that's routine to advise the bar of a malpractice filing. If there was one.
Well, I'm suggesting, do you think you have any obligation to self-report to the State Bar of Hawaii what we've just been talking about?
No, I'm sorry.
Malpractice claim or not?
No, I don't think I do. I'm not. I don't.
Okay.
I don't see that as an ethical issue. I'm sorry.
Okay. On the statute of limitations question raised by Judge Hawkins, if the, say, the contract as a whole was determined to be unconscionable, but the statute of limitations provision itself was not determined to be unconscionable, would you apply the statute of limitations provision independently, even though the contract was determined to be unconscionable?
Well, I certainly hope not, and that's why I'm here. And my position is, if the whole arbitration agreement is permeated with unfair provisions, as I believe it is,
you wouldn't say it's severable. In other words, once you decide the contract as a whole is unconscionable, then no part of it would be enforceable.
And the statute of limitations would fall with the rest of the contract. It's not because there's permeation, because there's a failure of the primary purpose to provide a fair playing field. I think the authorities justify no severance in that situation. One of the issues that we deal with, which may be somewhat different from other cases, is the question of the applicable law. Ameriquest has raised a big fuss about that in their briefs by saying, as Judge Mulway said, that she was limited to simply looking at what Hawaii law was. And I've made a point to try to suggest that that's not so, because we deal with federal common law, federal substantive law under the FAA, and that means that any case decided by whether a state or federal court anywhere in the country under the FAA is part of that federal substantive common law. And so I think no court dealing with such a case as this wears blinders on what they can look at and see, and it's fair game to look beyond the borders of Hawaii to what is happening all over the country on this issue. If you look at the Brown decision itself, which is the Hawaii Supreme Court case that we're dealing with, it made the same comments about the federal substantive common law as Judge Posner did in the Cigna case. And the Brown case cited decisions by, well, all the Supreme Court decisions, and then decisions from California, Georgia, Indiana, Kansas, New York, Texas, and Washington, as well as federal authority. So it went beyond its borders to shape what it viewed as the law. And the same thing for Armendariz in California. Justice Moss went outside of California and cited Graham Oil by this court, Schenkel by the First Circuit, Rosenberg by the First Circuit, Palladino by the 11th Circuit, Williams by the 5th Circuit, Kowaleski by the 7th Circuit. It went likewise beyond the borders of California to shape the law. And so I don't think we're limited at looking at what Brown says. But if we were, and Brown is the only case we look at, the question then is what would the Hawaii Supreme Court do? All we know in Brown is that in Brown it did not find that the employee was disadvantaged by the arbitration agreement. It said there was no proof of unfairness. But what would the Supreme Court do in Hawaii, the Hawaii Supreme Court, with that issue, what you look at to determine unfairness? Would it not look outside its borders to see what other courts around this whole country are doing and what kinds of provisions they are holding to be unfair and what they're not? And I think the answer is clear that they certainly would look beyond their borders to look at that question. The last thing I'd like to cover is what is the true fact concerning whether litigation or arbitration is most costly, which is most costly. In the opening brief, I suggested that we've been dealing with statements from courts early on in the arbitration business saying, oh, we all know that litigation is far more expensive. And I've suggested the paradigm for that is when both sides are large law firms billing on the hourly basis and charging their clients as they go. That paradigm does not hold true for litigation in the employment context for wrongful discharge or for Title VII or whatever it is. And I've suggested in the opening brief that what does hold true, this is contingent fee litigation, whereas in my case, I've asked my client to pay the costs. And so you have to look at what the real expenses are to a litigant who is required to arbitrate and what those costs really are, with the understanding that the client is going to have to pay those costs. Now, the Morrison case in the Sixth Circuit just a few months ago was one of those I cited in my letter to the court. Talks about contingent fee litigation. It's the only case I've seen which does that. But the assumption made by the Sixth Circuit in Morrison is that the contingent fee plaintiff's lawyer is putting up all the costs and fronting all the costs. Now, that may happen for some contingent fee lawyers, but I don't think it does for a great many others, including myself, where we ask the client to pay those costs. So,
don't you have costs in litigation as well as in arbitration?
No, not the same.
You don't take depositions when you litigate a case?
Yes, and we're not talking about the deposition costs. That's not part of our list of costs which Judge Mulway ordered AmeriQuest to pay. The significant costs are, in our case, are the travel expenses to get from Hawaii to California, the airfare for my client, me, and maybe 10 witnesses.
I must confess, I just do not understand your argument or your position. Let me start with this question. Was your client's claim ripe any time after November 30, 1999, when she was terminated?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was your client's claim ripe at any time after November 30, 1999?
I'm sorry, would she claim what after that date?
You know what the word ripe means?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I didn't hear that.
Was your client's claim ripe after 11/30/99?
Certainly. Yeah.
And so at any time, the next day or the next week, at any time within a year after November 30, 1999, you could have gone to district court in Hawaii and did exactly what you did after June 28, 2001?
Yes, of course.
Okay. And the only thing that impeded you from doing that was your concern, reflected by your requirement of your client, that she deposit money for the cost of arbitration in your trust fund, right?
Yes, sir.
Travel to Hawaii, depositions and the like.
Yes.
Yet that's exactly what you were trying to avoid by going to district court, and exactly what you want this court to say, right?
No, not
you want us to tell Judge Mulway that this arbitration agreement should not be enforced, right?
That's right.
Because it's unconscionable. And one of the aspects of its unconscionability is the one-year statute of limitations. That's your position, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And you don't think you're prejudiced? You put your client in any kind of jeopardy by waiting until June 28, 2001 to file?
Yes, I did.
And you think that's not an ethical problem?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Your Honor, that's, I think, concludes my time, and thank you.
All right. Thank you.
You bust the court with this.
Good morning, Your Honors. Elizabeth Murphy appearing this morning on behalf of the defendant AmeriQuest Mortgage Company with the law firm Buckhalter, Niemer, Fields & Younger. First of all, I want to thank Mr. Smith for his points and for allowing me to be here this morning. Most of the issues have been briefed. In fact, all of them, as far as I can see, have been briefed, with the exception of some of Mr. Smith's points regarding subsequent case law, which most of which I find to be irrelevant. The only case that's come out from this court has been the Ferguson case, which is distinguishable, as I also, I think, mentioned in my brief. But in any event, there are just a few points I want to make this morning. First of all, the question of controlling law, I think it's a straightforward question. I don't know that it really bears additional discussion, but Mr. Smith brought it up, so I thought I would respond. Hawaii law applies in this instance. I don't disagree that it's appropriate at times to look to other states or other circuits in order to determine whether there's an appropriate or an applicable case. However, when you have state law that applies clearly, in this case the contract provides, and also this court has noted in the Ferguson case that it is appropriate to apply state law to the question of the enforceability of an arbitration agreement such as this.
Refusal of AAA to undertake the arbitration.
What do I make of it?
Yeah. Well, what should we make of it?
I don't think you need to make anything of it. I think the AAA has its own rules and guidelines that it follows, that the AAA is an organization that doesn't have any binding authority in this particular instance, and its decisions I don't think are relevant at all for purposes of
this
appeal.
What's the largest and oldest national alternative dispute resolution organization, maybe in the world, certainly in the United States. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree, Your Honor.
And ordinarily, they're happy to have parties send matters to them for arbitration, right?
Absolutely.
And since they depend upon business being referred to them, isn't it a bit of an oddity for them to say, no, we won't undertake this?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's necessarily an oddity. I think the AAA is being careful these days in light of the disparate rulings that we see lately in this issue with regard to the enforceability and particularly the issue of whether these arbitration agreements are unconscionable.
They declined to arbitrate specifically because, number one, the arbitration agreement here was made an express condition of Domingo's employment, correct?
Well, that's one of the reasons, yes.
And because it narrowed, the agreement purported to narrow Hawaii's two-year statute for bringing cases of this kind to 1 year.
Right. Well, Your Honor, in subsequent cases that I've personally dealt with the AAA since this decision was made by the AAA on this case years ago, the AAA has reversed its position and is accepting this particular arbitration agreement, verbatim, exactly the same agreement, for administration from its Fresno office. I have actually four or five cases pending currently in that office with regard to this exact same agreement.
What is your client's position with regard to the enforcement, if it's enforceable, of the one-year statute?
What is my client's position with regard to the enforcement? I think that our position with regard to that is that the one-year statute of limitations contained in the agreement is enforceable.
So if we affirm Judge Mulway across the board, you'll what, move to dismiss the arbitration as untimely?
Well, that would be a question that we would take up if and when that occurs, since we haven't gotten
to that. But your client is certainly not waiving that provision. If we were to affirm the district court, to agree with your argument and affirm Judge Mulway, this matter, if to the extent Domingo can pursue a claim, it would be within the bounds of arbitration.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and we certainly are reserving that right and would probably make that decision at the appropriate time.
And if you were successful in that regard, Domingo would have no claim.
That's correct.
And we must assume, if we affirm, that you will make that motion to dismiss it. Otherwise, we'd leave it out there and say we affirm if you later do one thing, but we don't affirm if you later do the other.
Right.
That wouldn't do, would it?
No.
We can't write that. So
right.
We must assume that you will exercise your rights if we give them to you.
Right.
I don't mean give them to them, if we affirm that you have them.
I think that's right, but I think it's important for us to focus on the fact that what we're looking at is whether the agreement is enforceable, and that is all. And what comes beyond that, and what happens after this ruling, is beyond the question of what we're here for today.
Would I be correct in assuming that there's an ethics component to the bar examination in Hawaii?
I would assume so, although I haven't taken that bar examination, Your Honor.
You're not a member of the Hawaii bar.
I am not.
Okay.
Although I was admitted pro hoc for this particular case.
Where are you admitted?
I'm admitted in California and in pro hoc in Texas and in a few other states.
Does California place an obligation upon lawyers to report ethical misconduct occurring within their eyesight?
I believe it does, Your Honor.
Okay. Have you reported on your opponent?
I have not.
Do you think you should?
I might. I haven't really, for me to report an opponent on an ethical violation would take a lot of thought, pre-thought, and I haven't yet gone through that process because I was dealing primarily with what was going to happen with the case.
The rules are different from state to state, but I will tell you, in my home state in Arizona, it is a separate ethical violation to not do that. In other words, lawyers have been suspended and disbarred for not reporting possibly ethical misdeeds that they knew about, were aware of, and didn't report. Is that the case in California?
I don't know, but I would assume so.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, I was speaking about the question of what law applies. I think it's clear that Hawaii law applies. And when we look at Hawaii law, we have a case called Brown versus Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's a wrongful termination case. It's right on point. And it provides instruction and guidance with regard to this issue of whether this agreement should be enforced or not.
So Hawaii law applies, but not its statute of limitations.
No, that's correct. The statute of limitations set forth in the agreement applies because the parties are free to set their own statute of limitations. And Hawaii law, again, is going to apply to the question of whether the agreement itself is enforceable. I think it's important that we just note quickly that under the Brown case, the facts were a little bit less favorable even than they are here. And what I'm saying is that in that particular case, the arbitration clause was embedded in a job application form that was only signed by the plaintiff. And the Kentucky Fried Chicken court, the Brown court in Hawaii, held nonetheless that the arbitration agreement was fully binding and enforceable in that particular case.
Well, that was that covered whether or not it was entered into when it was embedded in the application and signed by only one party. Question, did they ever enter into one?
Yes.
Now, having entered into one, you have to look to see whether it's enforceable.
That's right.
And that has to do with this unconscionable.
That's right.
And that can vary between California and Hawaii.
It varies from state to state, from circuit to circuit. It varies from case to case, depending on the terms of the particular arbitration agreement in question. There is no clear rule on this issue, and I'm sure Your Honors are very well aware of that.
In looking at the agreement, I take it that there's no disagreement that we look at the agreement as a whole. But in looking at the agreement as a whole, do we look at it as written, or do we look at it in the light of the concessions that AmeriQuest attempted to make?
Well, I think what we're looking at is whether or not to affirm Judge Malloway's ruling, and Judge Malloway's ruling looked at the agreement as a whole in light of AmeriQuest's concessions with regard to the fee-splitting provision and the venue provision. And I don't know, her order didn't say she was severing those, but the district court has great discretion in determining how to rule on these things, and she merely said that because AmeriQuest had offered to concede on those issues, that they were moot for purposes of what she was doing. In addition to which, again, Hawaii law controls in this issue, and Hawaii law, the case of Huff, stands for the proposition that severance is appropriate in Hawaii as long as you can sever out an offensive provision without doing, quote, violence to the underlying objectives of the agreement, which is a standard that is far more lenient than the standard even used in here in California under the Armendariz case, which
we all
know.
It sounded to me like the judge accepted the offer to waive certain parts of it and made a decision based upon that, and you'd be hard put to not be stopped to assert them now.
Right.
Having told the judge you wouldn't.
Oh, no, I don't plan to. Yeah. We plan to have this arbitration, if it goes forward, in Hawaii, with AmeriQuest bearing all of the fees and costs that Ms. Domingo would not otherwise have to incur if this case was in litigation.
I'm troubled, although it seems to me it's just a question that should either trouble or not trouble the Hawaiian courts, about the one witness, one deposition provision. That's pretty tough to choose the one company employee that you might want to find out what they're going to say, knowing full well that if you find out they're not going to hurt you, the company has a half a dozen more that will, and you don't know about them.
I would agree, Your Honor, and that's precisely why the agreement allows the arbitrator to order additional discovery on a showing of good cause.
Aren't there cases, and I'm asking for information, you've done this work a good deal, I think, where the court lets the case go to arbitration because the arbitrator can carve out any that the arbitrator wants to.
Carve out anything that the arbitrator wants to?
Anything that he can enforce parts of the agreement and not enforce parts that are offensive. That would be the type of thing that in California would make it unenforceable.
Well, I think the carving out would be done at the stage where a court is deciding whether to enforce the agreement.
The agreement. Well, if the arbitrator made a ruling that excused one party from a harsh provision, they would determine whether they would enforce that agreement.
I suppose so.
One thing, once it goes into arbitration, they can do just about anything.
Well,
they are not even bound to follow the law, are they?
Well, no, that's not in our case, Your Honor. In our case, the arbitration agreement specifically says that the arbitrator shall apply the substantive law and the procedural law of the state in which the claim arose and or federal law, as the case may be. So,
and if he does so?
Do they do so?
Correctly or not. That's it, isn't it?
Well, isn't that always it?
No, they bring them up here.
I would hope that the arbitrator that we select and the arbitrator that the AAA panel would provide us with would be an arbitrator who would apply the law correctly, Your Honor.
Well, I always hope all judges do.
Well, in looking at the agreement, and you look at a provision that's on its face appears disadvantageous to the employee, like the limited discovery. Do you weigh that in the balance when looking at unconscionability on the assumption that the arbitrator can do something right to relieve the employee of the adverse effects of that, or you just take it as it's written?
No, I think what you do is you look at the agreement as a whole, and with regard to offensive provisions under applicable authority here, you decide whether or not those those offensive provisions can or should be severed without doing violence to the underlying purpose of the agreement. And then, pursuant to the party's right to contract into arbitration, you know, the parties have a right to contract, they've signed a contract. Pursuant to that right, you then give it over to the arbitrational authorities and tribunal, and you let the chips fall in that forum.
Now, did the district court sever the limited discovery provision?
No, she did not.
So if that order is enforced, it would be up to the arbitrator to walk around that provision.
Then. That's correct. The arbitrator?
The agreement gives him authority to do that.
That's right. And it doesn't, again, it's not necessarily a limitation. You know, the whole purpose of arbitration, recall, is to streamline proceedings and to make things go quicker and more efficiently. And so to have a limitation on discovery, it's not really a limitation. It's just a sort of a guideline that says one deposition per side. Requests for production, Your Honors, are not limited in this particular case. The arbitrator can decide to allow more discovery if that's warranted. And I think that that's an entirely, first of all, it's totally mutual, that provision. It's not one-sided. It doesn't necessarily benefit one side over the other. And the arbitrator can, in his or her discretion, decide to allow additional discovery on a showing of good cause. I don't see how that's unfair, one-sided, or anything else. I mean, this is arbitration after all.
Would you agree that we don't give any deference to the district court decision, that we review this de novo?
I do agree that de novo is the standard, but whether or not you decide to give deference to Judge Malloway's ruling, I suppose, is a matter of your own authority or your own discretion.
Well, de novo review, I think, implies no deference.
That's right.
Deferential standards of review.
Right. It does. And this is a de novo review, so technically you can scrap her opinion and start over.
Am I right that what our job is not to decide whether we think something is unconscionable, but to decide whether the Hawaiian courts would find it unconscionable?
That's exactly right.
And we must predict what they would do with this case.
I suppose predict, but we have some
based upon their decisions in the past.
We have some very nice guidelines and some nice rulings out of Hawaii that provide us with a lot of assistance in predicting.
If we review it de novo, then I suppose we, in effect, are sitting as the district court, or sitting in the same place as the district court, and we could affirm by adding some further severance if we wanted, couldn't we?
Well, I suppose you could.
In other words, we could sever the statute of limitations provision.
You sure could. I mean, I don't find it to be unconscionable. I think that there's authority that would uphold that provision. In fact, it's actually less advantageous to AmeriQuest than it is to the plaintiff, because the EEOC statute of limitations is typically 180 days, 6 months, whereas the agreement in this case allows a year. And a claim that might be brought by AmeriQuest carries a two-year statute of limitations under Hawaii law. Therefore, the agreement actually hurts AmeriQuest by limiting its rights, and it gives the plaintiff additional rights by giving her essentially another 6 months on her own statute of limitations.
You sound like you think you might could get out of it because it's unconscionable.
As opposed
to your client.
Like I said, we're going to take that question up after this process is finished. All right. Did you have another question, Your Honor?
No.
Okay. Well, there's one more issue that counsel didn't necessarily raise during his opening argument, but I think it's an important one, and it comes to mind when anybody with a reasonable mind looks at this agreement, and that is whether or not the carve-out provision has any negative effect on the enforceability. And as briefed, our position is that it does not. And as Judge Malloway stated, it's really not an issue anyway, because AmeriQuest's statute of limitations to bring any counterclaim or any claim against Mr. Mingo has long since passed. It had no intention of doing so. It has no intention of doing so. And so whether or not AmeriQuest's theoretical right to bring a claim against Mr. Mingo for some sort of unfair competition issue is not really a question that we need to be bothered with. And that's what Judge Malloway said in her decision, that it wasn't an issue because it's just not on the table. If AmeriQuest had a counterclaim against Ms. Domingo for unfair competition, or if AmeriQuest had brought a separate case against Ms. Domingo, then I think we would have something to talk about. But again, looking at Hawaii law, there's a case, a 1993 case, the Kamaole case, where it's stated that this type of, or a carve-out like this, is not going to offend the underlying objects of the arbitrate or the agreement, as long as there's an important interest motivating its presence in the agreement, and in that case the court enforced the agreement notwithstanding the carve-out. And in the underlying papers that we filed with the district court, we provided a declaration of Ginger Crawford, who is the human resources director of the company, setting forth the, quote, business realities that justify the need for that carve-out, although, again, it's not an issue in this particular case because we aren't bringing any counterclaim against Ms. Domingo. And
what was the case you cited for the proposition that Hawaii law allows the court to sever out the conceded provisions? I think you said Huff?
I did, Your Honor. There was a case in Hawaii called Huff.
H-U-F-F?
H-U-F-F. Would you like to cite?
If you have it.
I do. It's in my brief.
Oh, fine. If it's in your brief, I just didn't get here with it.
It's a case under Hawaii law where the issue was a little bit different. It was a question of whether or not the Hawaii state antitrust statute provides an individual right of action. There was also an arbitration question in that case.
Is this IE versus Frank Huff Agency?
That's right.
That's the case you're talking
about? That's right, Your Honor. It was overruled in part on other grounds, which is cited in our brief also. But the purpose of the purpose for us citing this case is because it does stand for the proposition that the standard under which we do sever unlawful or offensive provisions under Hawaii law is a great deal more lenient than the standard we have here in California. That is the permeated standard, permeated by unconscionability standards set forth in Armendariz and followed in a number of this court's subsequent decisions. Again, we sever provisions as long as we can do so without doing violence to the contract's essential objects.
All right.
All right. I think that's all I have, Your Honors. Are there any other questions?
I guess not. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
You had a couple of minutes left, I believe.
I'd like to make one comment on the preceding argument, and that concerns the
the technique that Judge Mulway used to accomplish the result of her decision, which was, as I said, to extract the agreement from Ameriquest that would pay unique costs, and having so agreed, Judge Mulway could then say, well, any question on fairness is moot. It's our position in the briefs that that constitutes a rewriting of the agreement, that any effort by Ameriquest to change the terms of the arbitration coming after all of the events, post-execution modification.
Do you object to their giving your client that break?
Yes, we did. We did and we do. We'll put that on the record.
You object to their making the agreement more favorable to your client?
Oh, to accept the post-execution modification would have been to give up the ability to attack the agreement as void, and we could not do that for the reasons the court has noted and I've been candid to say.
So do you disagree with your opposing counsel's statement on what the Huff case says about allowing review of the contract after severing the obnoxious provisions?
No, I don't agree. I don't disagree on the holding of that case. I'm just saying it was totally inapposite because it's a 20-year-old antitrust case. It doesn't deal with severance in the employment litigation, wrongful discharge context. It's just not a pertinent authority, and there's no other law in California and Hawaii that I know of that deals with that issue. So
we have to look to the law that best predicts it, don't we?
Well, you can do it
like
that way.
Like a 20-year-old antitrust case might predict how an employment contract would be interpreted, wouldn't it?
You can certainly.
Might help us.
If you're going to take the prediction route, then you certainly would look.
But how else are we going to rule on the case? Just my hunch, what I think is good or bad about this contract, or what the Hawaiian courts think?
No, Your Honor, I think you're totally free to look outside the borders of Hawaii.
I know to find out what Hawaii would do.
I'm sorry?
I can look outside of Hawaii to find out, if I can, what Hawaii courts would do with this.
That's if you're going the prediction route. But yes, in answer to your question, that is one way to solve that
problem. Another route to go, you see.
Well, the other route, as I've said, is to just accept the fact this is part of the federal substantive common law. And any case dealing with the severance issue in the employment context under the FAA is fair game. It's part of the authority.
And just skip the state court's holdings altogether.
Weigh them as part of the total picture, but acknowledge the fact that case, the Huff case, was an antitrust.
You're extending to me somewhat more authority than I think I have.
Oh.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
The case just argued will be submitted, and we'll go then to the next case, which is Redding against Hitachi.
Mr. Smith, on your flight back to Hawaii, can you hear me all right? On your flight back to Hawaii, you need to ask yourself this question. Would I be better off reporting this to the Hawaii State Bar myself or having someone else do it? Okay?
That's right.
Thank you.
The court, of course, can do it.
Think about it.
I might also add, Mr. Smith, that Judge Hawkins' views on that question are his, not necessarily those of the panel.
I'm sorry?
Judge Hawkins' views on the questions he put to you are his questions and his views, not necessarily those of the panel.
Thank you.